Okay, are we live?
Yeah. We can start with a presentation mode. An introduction.
I think you should be able to hear this. According to all our little lights and buzzers here, we are live and we're on. If you folks can keep your mute buttons on unless and until you want to ask a question or we have a dialogue going, that would be good. Otherwise, we're going to be hearing each other's breathing and coughing, and with so many people, it could really get magnified and it would get in the way. So if you can keep your mute buttons on right now until we open it up for questions, that would be great. This is Tamarack, and I'd like to start with a story, actually just a recounting of the family year-long experience 2012-2013 as it relates to the kids. I learned so much from them in a natural setting. You know, as many of you know, I've been involved with kids for a long time in a teaching role, whether it's doing on nature education classes or guiding families on wilderness expeditions or working as a counselor, family counselor. I've had a lot of exposure to children in various contexts. But one context that I did not really have personal experience with, that I only knew about academically and partially through my time spent on the reserves, on the native reserves up here in the North Woods and a couple other places in the country, I was never really immersed in a children's culture, real, live, functional children's culture. And we did it here during that year-long, 2 years ago, and it was phenomenal. We had 17 children, and they went out in the woods with their families, with their siblings, with no toys. No toys. Can you imagine this? Kids without toys? Well, and this is something that I learned. It's something that I knew was possible, entirely possible, or I would not have set it up this way. I would not have proposed it. All of the parents wanted to bring along something, whether it was colored pencils, crayons, watercolors, some basic toys, or some supplies and materials to make toys. Kids and toys just go together, or so we think in this culture. Well, it turns out that the no toys were brought. Everybody understood the basic concept once it was explained to them of how children are inventive and how imaginative they are, how imaginative the children become when there's more than one child together. When you get two or more kids together, they invent all kinds of things. And this is the way we want to be as adults, right? But we do not raise our children that way. We do so much for them. We think we're doing our children a favor when we get them special toys and when we get them books and all the various things we get them. And what happened here, it's just an amazing story, and I'll keep it short because I'd like to get you folks involved right away and have a dialogue not only about the child rearing, which is very very important to me, but about Native life way in general, because children are just a part of it, just as our elders and the mothers and the guardians and all the other people involved. And even more so than that, which we'll probably explore, is that Native community is not just about people. Native people go to join a community that already exists, the community of all the relations, the plants and animals and the wind and the trees. And this is why there's such stability and such peace in Native hunter-gatherer communities. They're not trying to reinvent the wheel. They're not trying to change the world. They are of the world already. And we'll get into that shortly. But one thing I want to describe here is what happened with these kids. There were 17 kids. A few of them were siblings. Most of them did not know each other before they got here. However, by the time they got out to camp, they had a 7-mile hike out to camp. And by the time they got there, they knew each other very well because they were talking and having a great time and playing games all the way out. They did it all on their own. They didn't have any problem at all. Parents did not have to entertain them. There was movement. There was action. There was activity. And they fell right into pace. They did beautifully. Even the very youngest ones, the 2.5 and 3.5-year-olds, they had a great time going out to camp. They got to be carried by different adults. They got to walk for a while. We stopped to explore things on the way. It was a great time. But back to no toys. I say no toys, but actually it's the reverse of that. Think reverse logic, because oftentimes when we talk, when we get attached to something, that is a sign that we need to look at the opposite. We need to look at the reverse of it, because that is usually closer to the truth, or at least it's a big segment of the truth, because as soon as we have a belief system, as soon as we have an attachment, that means we're closing off to something else. And oftentimes it's out of fear, or we have a vested interest, and we have to hang on because we're afraid of what happens if we let go, that there's nothing there. But that's actually where we need to be. We need to dwell in the void, what the old Zen masters call the void, which is that place of letting go, just letting go of all we have, all we know, all we believe in. And we're not losing anything. We're actually gaining everything else other than what we thought we knew, other than what we thought was truth and reality. The world is much bigger than our puny little brains can wrap around, let me tell you. I'm sure all of you are aware of that. But awareness isn't enough. We have to do it. We have a saying here in the Guardian training, only actions speak. Anyway, again, getting back to toys, what I'm arriving at before I get off on this tangent is that no toys opens up to all toys, because when children do not have toys to gravitate to, everything around them becomes a potential toy. They become engaged in their environment. They look at things in a different way. These aren't just things that get in the way anymore of their specific toy or their specific game they want to play. They start seeing the play potential in whatever's around them, whether it be sticks or stones or bones or whatever, feathers. And it was just phenomenal. I'll give you a couple examples here. And I don't want to dominate the conversation. I'll keep this short. But what happened is that they looked around them in their environment. Children want to play. Kids and play go hand in hand, of course. And they picked up things. And it's amazing as to what they did. They made gliders, believe it or not. They made gliders that actually flew out of feathers. They found turkey feathers, big turkey feathers, and they found some quirky mushrooms. And they were sticking the feathers in the mushrooms to make wings and tails and such. And pretty soon they had gliders that they were throwing around, having a great time with it. And just the feathers themselves, they noticed that the sparks off of the fire were flying way up with the column of hot air that goes off of the fire. So one of the kids got the idea that, hey, feathers drift in the wind, right? Let's throw a feather in the plume of hot air coming off of the fire. And they did, and the feathers went high, 50, 100 feet high, and they drifted off. And all the kids ran after them to try to catch them. And they had a great time, and they never got tired of it. They just played and played and played with these feathers drifting in the wind, and they never knew how high they were going to go or where they were going to come down. So every feather going up was an adventure. So such a simple little thing as a feather in an updraft. They had a great time with it. And it didn't stop there. We all know how kids love role-playing games. They like assuming other caricatures. And they had big fun with pine cones, believe it or not. There are different kinds of pine cones here. There are white pine cones, which are big, and the red pine cones are small and stout. The white pine cones from the white pines are long and narrow. Red pines are short and stout. Hemlock pine cones are very small. They're petite, and very almost flaky looking. They're really pretty. And there are balsam fir cones and hemlock cones and white spruce cones, red spruce cones, black spruce cones, balsam fir cones. There are a lot of different types of cones. And what they did was that they had these pine cones represent characters in their role-playing games. And the pine cones had different values. The rarer the pine cone, the more value it had, which gave it the most power. So they had mock battles going, and they had villages they constructed out of fern and sticks and leaves and such, and they created their own little world and had a great time with it. And they would do this, of course, if they were given toys, if they were given little toy figurines and various implements and such to create their own role-playing games, sort of pre-made figures. But here they had to do it from scratch. They had to use their own imaginations to create the scenario for the game that wasn't done, as in a board game that you would get purchased. They had to make up their own characters, which they wouldn't have to do in a board game that was given to them or purchased. And then they had to construct all of the scenarios for the game and attach all the values in the game to the various components. It was amazing. They did it, and they all participated. All the kids from 3.5 years of age up to 15, they were all playing these games together. And they found a place for each other. They created spaces for each other. There's very little competition. There were only 17 kids, and in order to have the variety of characters for the game, everybody wanted everybody to play. It was beautiful. There wasn't the exclusivity that you often find when you have a group of 20 or 30 or 40 kids, all the same age, all in the same classroom. There, in order for them to distinguish between themselves, there's competitiveness and there's a hierarchy that evolves. And you have dominant kids and you have the cast-out kids. It did not happen here. Everybody was involved. Everybody was engaged. All of the kids cared for each other. It's not that there weren't some tussles now and then, that's for sure. However, they worked out their own tussles even. We stayed back. And this was something that the parents had to get used to, because they were used to being the referees, the judges, the juries, the moderators. And they didn't realize that kids are perfectly capable of doing that on their own, thank you. Just stand back. And the reason it worked so well is because there are immediate consequences. And those are consequences that are either circumstantial or they were levied by each other. They were peer consequences. They did not come from adults. They did not come from any structure or any rules at school or anything like that. They were peer consequences, and they worked things out pretty quickly, and it was forgive and forget, and they were right back to playing again. It was really nice to see. I think that's enough. That's enough of an introduction. As you can tell, I'm really involved in children's culture. I'm finishing up a book right now on Native-oriented child rearing. Topic that's immediately at hand. However, don't let that stop you. I have an interest in all aspects of Native life, so I'm willing to explore anything and listen to your stories too. Does anybody have something you'd like to comment on or contribute? Okay, in order to unmute yourselves, I just got a recording here. Press *6 and you'll be able to talk. There's only one online. Okay. No questions yet? Okay. I have one here that was sent in. Let's see. How do we learn or relearn to live with and close to Mother Nature in mind, spirit, and in the physical, with daily hours in the car to get to work, to make a living, and some 30 quote-unquote neighbors within 25 meters of my living room? That is a very, wow.
Maybe read it.
That's a powerful question. I'll read the rest of this here. She sent a long email, and it is, in order to get a feel for where this, for the context of this question, I'll read the whole email. I live in the Netherlands, as you may or may not know, one of the most overpopulated countries in the world, and lacking financial opportunities to buy myself a home with some, let's see, to have at least some land to grow things on and to find some peace and quiet there. In this country, square meters are extremely expensive. Boy, square meters. That's wild. So this is where my question comes from. And I'll reread it because it's within the context of a longer paragraph. How do we learn or relearn to live with and close to Mother Nature? To do that in mind, spirit, and in the physical. With daily hours in the car to get to work, make a living, and with some 30 neighbors within 25 meters of my living room. As a child, I used to walk my dog for hours, spending part of that time lying in the tall grass, watching the clouds and the birds, feeling the small ones crawl up my legs, and listening to the sounds of the grass, crickets, and me and my dog finding peace away from the emotional turbulence of our family life. Now, even the meadows are a no-go area. Tall grass is scarce, and peace and quiet is even more scarce. I want to be of service to this abused planet of ours and all beings who live here. Instead, I'm teaching biology from books. The school is in the midst of a big city. The kids who don't know one tree from another, who think that pollution is something the government takes care of, that all food from grocery store is fine, as it has been approved of. And by the way, it's not our Earth Mother who provides this food. It comes from the factories and stores. So sad that more than half of them have a condition like ADD or ADHD or something similar, or they're autistic. And she ends it with, how do I help myself and them? The greater good of all. Wow. There's a lot here. There's a lot here. And I think what she's saying is a metaphor for where all of us are at, what all of us are facing, whether it is Marianne in the Netherlands, which is one of the most crowded countries in the world for sure, or it's you in LA or me here in the Northwoods of Wisconsin. We are all here on the same planet, and it is definitely crowded. We are eating ourselves out of house and home, literally. I just saw some data that states that if we keep living the way we do, it's going to take three planets to support us. We are literally eating ourselves out of house and home. We're consuming all of our quote-unquote resources. And part of the reason for that is because we see what's around us as resources. Created for our good, right? Created for us to consume. And we're doing it. So something has to break somewhere. Something's going to happen, there's no doubt about it. But Marianne's question here is very personal, though. What can she do? How can she return to that innocence of youth where she can go out with her dog in the meadow and listen to the birds and feel the bugs on her legs? Listen to the sounds, the grass. How can she do that? Here she is in the middle of the city. Well, there's one thing I've done, and that is to not look at having to go out there in order to be at one with nature. And the first thing I've done, and I learned this when I was very young, when I was probably same age as Marianne when she was going out with her hug. And that is that I am nature, that I have these natural yearnings and inclinations inside of me. It's all there already. I don't have to go out to nature in order to connect with nature, because nature is me and I am nature. And this has worked so well for me when I was a kid. And sometimes I would get in trouble because I'd be, quote-unquote, daydreaming in class, looking out the window, or watching a fly or even a butterfly who got in the window. We had real windows back then that opened and closed. So we could actually open them and hear the birds. And the butterflies come in. It's a beautiful distraction. But anyway, what's important here is that what we have done is to separate ourselves from nature. Now we are looking, as Marianne is here, on how to reconnect and how to help others reconnect. And we've created this line. This is the city, that's the country. This is civilized, that's wild. And we're trying to breach that line all kinds of ways, spiritually, culturally. We're creating parks and wildernesses so that we have a place to go to nature. We do it emotionally. We do it through art and music, always reaching out to try to connect with nature. Fireplaces, grills in our backyard. We want the hearth again. We want to be connected with fire. Artwork we hang in our houses. Everything, so much of what we do, I shouldn't say everything, because so much of it is not obvious. What we're after is that reconnect. And even in our social instincts, wanting to reconnect with each other is an aspect of reconnecting with our old clan ways. We miss it. We miss the way we used to live naturally. Living naturally is living in nature. So here we have a woman who's wondering how to do that. And she's in the middle of a big city. And what she doesn't see, and Marianne, I think you're listening. I remember you calling in and saying that you're going to tune in and listen, so hopefully you're here. I can't tell because you're muted, of course. But what I would suggest is to sit down right in the middle of that big city and open up to nature. One of the first things you're going to see is pigeons. And these pigeons are wild, and they're living naturally. You see pigeons on buildings. Well, to the pigeons, those are not buildings, because these pigeons are still one with nature. Their nature is nature. Those buildings are cliffs. They're rock faces that they would normally nest in, normally roost on. The streets are the beaches and the open grasslands where they, and the parks where they go, are the open grasslands where they would normally go to scavenge for their food. It doesn't matter whether it's popcorn or wild seeds. They don't know the difference. They don't care. This is their food, this is their environment, this is their natural life. They're perfectly at home in the city as they would be on the cliff faces along the ocean, which is where all of our pigeons came from. That's where they evolved. And look around further, you're going to see sparrows, you're going to see starlings, you're going to see bees, believe it or not. Bees are prolific in the cities. A friend of mine who lives in the Bronx, New York City, just wrote an article for an online newsletter that one of the parks puts out. And she went around and found all the bees' nests, all the yellow jacket nests in the Bronx that she could see just from a sidewalk. She didn't go to any back areas in the parks or anything, just off of the sidewalks. And she found, I forget the count, but it was over a dozen yellow jacket nests. You've ever seen the hornet nests hanging up in trees, the big paper nests that they make. She found over a dozen of them. and she researched their lifestyle, and she started following the bees around to see what they were doing and where they were getting their food from. And she wrote this article that nobody could believe. People thought it was fiction at first, because she was talking about these bees and what they were doing as though she was out in the woods observing them. She wasn't. She was right there in the concrete jungle. There it all was. And she's going to write some more articles on more of the animals. Raccoons. There's a healthy raccoon population in New York City, believe it or not. Most people don't know about it because they come out at night and they stay in the quiet places where you can see them. And there are foxes in New York City. There are even coyotes in Central Park. And coyotes running through the streets at night. There's all of this going on in New York City. And for those of you who don't live in New York City, imagine what's going on around you. And the same in the Netherlands, wherever you're at. There's so much wildlife going on. And there's another piece here, too, because when I've been in the cities, I used to live in a city, not for long, believe me, but when I lived in Ithaca, New York, I would go down and sit in a busy place, a busy downtown area or a park where there was a lot of activity going on, or even a convention center where there was a convention going on. And I would sit and watch people the same way I would watch pigeons, or the same way when I'm out in the woods or in a lake and I'm watching the loons and the otters. I would watch people. And I would watch them going through their motions, and what you and I would see as, at least on the surface, of them going to catch a bus or stopping at a food vendor to buy something, or ushering their kids from across the street, any of the various things that people are doing, busy people in a busy city, are the same things that they would be doing if they were living out in the wilderness 10,000 years ago in a clan, living as our ancestors did. Same things. They were procuring food. They were caring for their children. They were migrating, moving, going from one place to another, taking care of their needs, admiring their surroundings. All of the various things they were doing, they were expressing their nature, which is nature. And here, if we can do these things, if we can see in our children, if we can see in ourselves, if we can see in each other, how we are manifesting nature all the time, how the pigeons are doing it, the sparrows in the city, the yellow jackets, it's all nature. We don't have to go out to nature. We can be immersed in nature right here and now. And if we can do that, we can impart this to our children. We can help to appreciate what is, not what could be or what was, but what is. And here's where we have to be. We have to be in the now, not trying to be some spiritually ascended person or some primitivist who, you know, is going back to how we used to live 1,000 years ago or anything, but right here and now, because that is all there is. The rest of it is just memory or memory, and imagination is not going to change us. All right, there's still a lot more here that I'd like to talk about, and maybe some of it will come up, excuse me, in some of the questions some of you might have. Does anybody have anything that you'd like to ask, or maybe you have a story to share, or another slant that we can take off on? I'm open to anything. You don't ask a question, you're going to have to listen to me more, and you're just going to have to take what comes. Okay, no questions. That means either you're falling asleep, and I'm boring you to death, or I have your rapt attention, whichever it is. Let's see. There's a lot more to talk about here. Okay. She says she's teaching biology from books, and the kids don't know one tree from another. Now, here there's a lot that you can do, Marianne. Teaching biology from books. I just gave some examples of how biology is right there. It could be a fly, in the schoolroom. Boy, flies have a tremendously varied lifestyle. It's an amazing lifestyle. Flies are the ultimate scavenger. Nearly every animal who dies is found by a fly. Fly lays eggs and maggots hatch, and the animal is consumed, and the fly is then consumed by the birds, and a small bird is consumed by a larger bird, and the cycle goes on. There's a beautiful example. Just have one fly in the classroom. There's not one there. Bring one in with you in the morning and let the fly go, and take off from right there. There's an old Zen saying about where to start, and a seeker asks, you know, where can I start? I want to become awakened. And the master turns to the seeker and says, start where you are. That's the only place there is anyway. Right here and now again, it's right back to that. So there, that one fly can open up a whole world for your students. They don't know their trees. I bet there are trees, at least potted trees, along that street by that school. There may be some trees planted in front of the school. There may be a nearby park. There are trees around in every city. In fact, one concept of cities that is gaining some popularity now is not to look at cities as cities where there happen to be some trees, but look at the cities as forests that we have moved in under, and we have built our houses and laid our roads and our sidewalks under the trees. And if we are to look at our urban areas, our suburban areas, as forests, with us living in the forest, it transforms itself right there. Instead of us being on top of the heap and controlling and manipulating the situation and destroying the forest, we have moved into the forest. Now we can be caretakers of the forest and transform our cities from the inside out. Imagine if we called Los Angeles Forest, or New York City Forest, or Chicago Forest. Imagine what that would do for us, because change starts with envisionment. We envision a forest, it's a forest, and we're going to help to manifest that. We're going to treat it as a forest. So, getting back to those trees, there are trees right around that school in biology class. Take your kids out to look at those trees and bring the books along if you would like, and identify those trees, not by just naming them. Identify those trees by coming to know them. Skip the names. The name ought to be the last thing that's attached to something rather than first, because what do? You notice people, a lot of birders, people who are into birds, have life lists, which for those of you who aren't aware of what birders do, they have a competition going sometimes to see how many birds they can see in their lives or on a bird count. And they have this checkoff list of all the different species. Oh, I've seen that. Checkoff. I've seen that bird. Check. I've seen that bird. Check, check. Right on down the list. And they can say, oh, I've seen 327 birds this year so far. How do they know those birds? They don't. They can identify the bird very well. They have binoculars. They have a field guide there, bird guides. Species, they have not established a relationship with that species, any of those birds. And here's what you can do with those trees. Go sit under the trees. Notice how a conifer differs from a deciduous tree. Deciduous trees with broad leaves shade the ground underneath, and notice how the grass is very sparse. But this conifer right next to the tree leaves a lot of light in, and there are various things growing under the conifer. Or if there are a lot of needles laying on the ground, it's too acid for anything to grow. Start noticing the relationship of this tree to the environment, whatever it is. And there's your takeoff point. And here's living biology. So much can be done with what appears to be so little. So rather than bemoaning our fate, we can accentuate the positive and grow from there. Now, and the thing is that we're planting seeds here, and it has nothing to do with biology per se or identifying trees. But what we're doing is, rather than showing the kids what they don't have, we're in the city here and we have to study out of this book because there's nothing here we can directly connect with. We're turning that around and saying, oh, there's life here. There's spirit here. There's relationship here. And now, all of a sudden, the children are going to take a new interest in their surroundings. They're going to look at their surroundings differently. And when they grow up, they're going to go off to college. They're going to come back. They're going to buy a house. Whatever they do, it's not just going to be something to do so that they can have time on the weekends or on their vacations to go camping or to go to the beach or anything. They're going to realize that life is all around them, and they are living in nature, their house in the city. Here's nature all around me. So they're going to treat things differently. They're going to be careful about, maybe they're going to think twice about the car they buy rather than an SUV. Maybe they will get a small economy car or an electric car. Or maybe they will put energy into public transit. They will carpool. Maybe they will plant more trees in the city. There's going to be a whole different attitude if we can raise a generation of children to realize that their nature is nature. They are immersed in nature wherever they are at, even in their classroom. Nature all around. Okay. Are there any questions yet? Is there anybody who would like to have a comment? Share a story. Maybe if you have some experience with kids, especially kids connecting with nature, or you've observed children out. Great to hear it.
Hi, Tamarack, it's Cindy.
Okay, go ahead. Can you speak up a little, please?
Can you hear me? It's Cindy.
Yep, now I can hear you. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I just want to say how much I'm enjoying this conversation because it's that perspective thing. I see you basically what you're saying is shift your perspective. Like you said before, there is no reality. It's only your perspective because or perception because what I hear a lot of is, you know, this is good, this is bad. Civilization is bad, man consumes. And you're giving everybody an opportunity to see what's good in all. I like that.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Because we, in our culture, we have a face-to-face culture. This is something I talked about yesterday in a training group here. We have a little technical difficulty here.
Okay. She just...
Okay. I think we're back on. Yeah. Cindy, I'm glad you brought that up. It's a very important point because we look at things as good and bad, and oftentimes what we're doing is hurtful, it's bad, it's destructive, and we need to be doing something different than what we're doing. And that becomes a real issue because now it affects us. It affects how we perceive ourselves. you know, we're hurting things. We're hurting Mother Earth. We're hurting each other. We should be living differently. And we're judging ourselves. We're judging other people. We are grading ourselves, whatever we do. And when we come from that perspective, we are never going to be happy. We're not going to be happy with ourselves. We're not going to be happy with each other. We're going to be judging each other. We're going to be getting involved in politics. We're going to be trying, it's going to be push and pull. We're going to be trying to establish legislation to protect people and places, to protect ourselves from each other. And we're going to be trying to essentially affect change from the outside rather than just being. And in order to do that, we really need to accept, not only accept, but to embrace. And the fundamental problem here, I think, comes from part of what we're doing right now. We're using a lot of words, and words are a tool. They're not an end in and of themselves. And what happens because of our culture is that we resort to words. And that's because we've isolated ourselves so much from each other. We no longer have this intuitive connection. We no longer understand nonverbal communication. We no longer acknowledge each other's presence, read body language. We can't hear the words in the wind, what the other animals are telling us anymore. It all needs to be translated for us. So we need to read books, we need to talk. And that's because we have isolated ourselves from nature. And as soon as we did that, we are no longer walking together with the other animals, but we have turned our faces away from them and to them. We turn our faces away from them to do things other than what we perceive as natural. And then we want to reconnect with nature. We turn our faces back to the animals and to nature. And here's our problem, because this creates a dichotomy. It's them and us. And that has filtered throughout our entire culture. What do we do to communicate? Now we have to face each other. We have to look each other in the eye. We can no longer intuit. We can no longer feel or sense. Well, we do it, but we're not consciously aware of it. We've lost touch with it. We've created hierarchies in order to take care of things around us. Even in our intimate relationships, we have isolated ourselves to the point where we are man and woman, or woman and woman, or whatever, and we pair up, and we need to face each other to be in relationship. We ask each other, how do you feel? We don't sense it anymore. We know how each other feel. Oftentimes when we ask, how do you feel, we don't mean it. Either we're nervous, we don't want to let on as to how we are feeling, so we're checking in with the other person because we don't want to be vulnerable. Well, I don't want to say, hey, I feel such and such, or I don't want to let on that I feel such and such. So I'm going to put the ball in the other person's court. I'm going to ask him how he feels, and I'm off the hook now. I can sit back. So there's this disconnect that has permeated our culture. And this is why, here going back to Marianne's email, she says, I have some 30 neighbors within 25 meters of my living room. You know, a meter's about a yard for those of us in the United States here. Imagine 30 people within 25 yards. That is about, if you're a big person, that's about 25 steps. 30 steps. Smaller person, 35 steps maybe, 30 people. And I bet if she's living in an apartment complex, for example, I bet she doesn't know the names of the majority of those 30 people, much less having any kind of a personal relationship with them. Isn't that crazy? Living with 30 of our own species right within spitting distance, just about. And we do not have a relationship with them. Instead, we sit in our apartments, and we are alone and lonely. We might have the TV on, or we're watching a movie, or we're listening to music, or we're texting a friend or something. We're on Facebook, or we have our cell phone constantly in our pockets, and constantly on, just waiting and hoping for a call. Don't want to miss anything. We crave relationship, and we are in the midst of relationship all around us. We're just tuned out to it, and that to me is terribly sad. And this is a reflection of our culture. We are alone in a sea of people, and people living in the suburbs. We have a house, we have a nice house, we have a rundown house, it doesn't matter. We still don't know our neighbor. Our relatives, our blood relatives, where do they live? Ladies and mine are scattered all over the country. Yeah, we stay in touch, we call, we go to visit them once or twice a year. We don't live together, we don't share the means and ends of our existence. We don't share our meals. We don't share the procurement of our food. We don't gather firewood together. This is nonverbal communication. This is the way we truly come to feel each other and feel our lives. Feel our lives, not just to empathize with each other, but to be in this direct, visceral relationship with each other. This is what we evolved to experience, and this is what fulfills us. We do not have to seek fulfillment if we are living fulfillment. And I don't want to give the impression that kinship is just blood, not by any means, because that's a very important component for sure. But for Native people, for Indigenous people, they oftentimes do not know who their blood parents are. That's for a couple of reasons. They may know their blood mother. That's hard to miss because blood mother physically bore you. However, it could be one of several fathers, perhaps one of several people who mother has or relationships with. And even if that is known or not known, the relationship beyond the conscious goes to the clan, because all of the women in the clan are the mothers to all of the children, and all of the men are the fathers, are the male role models to all of the children. So there's this rich relationship that is not based just on blood, but it's based on the deep rootedness of visceral relationship. And there's also the totemic relationship, the clan relationship. People of the bear clan, for example, or a bear totem in one clan, feel more closely related in a big sense to the people of bear totem in another clan down the river than they would to people of a different clan or of a different totem right within their own clan. So there's this relationship that is connected to the greater consciousness that is not just what we consider to be family. It's not so rigidly and strictly defined by genetics or by law. And this is the type of relationship we need to experience again if we are going to be open again to relationship with our non-human kin, because it's the same thing. We do not have a blood relationship with the tree. We do not have a blood relationship with a raccoon or a pigeon you see in the street. However, these animals are literally our kin. And if we can get beyond the them and us mentality, face-to-face mentality, realize that we are all facing in the same direction, we will again dwell in. And I have to be careful about my words here, because I'm saying, if we can get beyond. Now, that seems as though it's a future projection again, something that we are not now and do not have now. And that's not really correct. I need to watch my language. There's this thing with language. We use it, and just using language says something in and of itself. No matter what I want to say, the language is saying something on its own. And here's where it's really important to listen between and around the words. Because we already are nature. I've already talked about this. We don't have to get there. We just need to relax into it. Just breathe. Listen. Look. Reawaken our senses. It's all right here, within and without and about me. Right here, right now. I don't have to study. I don't have to do any special exercises or join any special kind of club or cult or anything. I already am. Everything else already is. And if we can just embrace, here we are. Cindy, is there anywhere else you'd like to go with that? Or is there something else I can address?
Kind of, but I think I'll save it for later because it's kind of big.
Okay. Okay.
But thank you. That was beautiful.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks. Well, your question was beautiful. That helped to open me up to what's inside of me, what I'd like to share. Let's see. I'd like to look back at... Oh, is there someone else with something to ask? Question? Okay, it was a false alarm. There's a little jingle that we hear here when someone wants to ask a question. It's just a false alarm. Marianne had so much to say here. Okay, oh, here's something so vitally important. This is about children, and this question, I'd like all of you to really listen to this, not listen to what I say, but just listen to what Marianne has, what Marianne's question is here, because, and I'll quote her, she says, it's so sad that more than half of the children in my classes have a condition like ADD, ADHD, autism, etc. More than half. Isn't that amazing? Now, what I see as important here is that she's looking at her children, and that child dwells within each of us. We think in a linear fashion in our culture. We think that, oh, we were conceived, we were an egg, then we were an embryo, and we were a child who's freshly born, a baby, and then a toddler, and on and up. And this is a very linear way of perceiving life. And it's not the way life is. If I look at a tree, is a tree just its outer growth ring? Those of you who understand how trees grow, they put on a new ring of growth each year on the outside of the trunk of the tree. And the inside of the tree is literally dead. The tree is not alive inside. The only living part of the tree is the cambium layer right under the bark, the very outside of the tree. However, all of the tree is there, and if it wasn't for all of these other growth rings that have accumulated, the tree would just flop over. The tree would have no structure, no strength. And this is where our strength comes from. Think of us as trees. We are putting on these growth rings as we go through all of these stages in life. Stages that started way before us. We have our ancestral memories that we carry from our far, far distant ancestors, way before we were human even. Imprinted in our DNA is all of this knowledge, all of this genetic knowledge, all of this ancestral wisdom. It was not just created by our parents in the sperm and in the egg. No. The sperm and in the egg is just culmination, the momentary culmination, all that came before and all that is to come. This is important because here, past, present, and future all come together because this egg and this sperm are the past, present, and future. They are not just the now. They are the continuum. because everything is imprinted in this egg and in this sperm to carry the organism that is to be created into the future. The future is already manifest in this egg and in this sperm. It only has to come to actualization. So it's already there. Now, if we can recognize this, just as in the tree, and just as in us, just as in my body, in my soul, I am my mother's egg yet. I am my father's sperm. I am the baby, the newborn baby. I am the toddler. All of that is within me. All that I have accumulated, all that I've learned, all that I have practiced, all that has been given to me by example, all of my hurts, every time I've fallen and scuffed my knee, that teaching is still with me, helping me to drive a car, helping me to paddle a canoe so that I can do it efficiently and safely. All of that is a part of me manifesting in every moment. Now, if I can see myself as being this full and complete being, child, adolescent, adult, elder, ancestor, the unborn, all of that is together with me right now. And now, look back at these children, and here I go with labels. Oh, this child has ADD. This child is autistic. Well, what does an ADD child manifest in the classroom? Let's take the classroom context, or act out, as you know, that's an extremely judgmental statement. This child is going to be, quote-unquote, distracted hundreds, if not thousands of times during the day, right? Well, this child is distracted. This child cannot pay attention to a lecture. This child cannot sit down and read a lesson. This child cannot complete a test. Whatever is going on, it's all about what this child cannot do and what this child should do. And here we are with this face-to-face culture again. We're judging. Okay, you are supposed to be this because this is what the culture asks of you. And you need to face this. You even have this term. Hey, face up. Face this. Okay, what are we facing? We are not facing ourselves. We are not facing our own perfection. We are facing an expectation. Now, this ADD child has something wrong with him because he cannot do what is expected of him. He has to face up to this. His teachers have to face up to this, and his parents do. So we take him to a counselor. We get him a prescription to, in essence, dumb him down. We'll be talking about this shortly, so that he can face up to the way he is supposed to be. Now, what he is naturally, normally, is tremendously, terribly inquisitive person, attracted to whatever is going on around him. And what else would I want a child to be, or what else would I want to be if I was living out in the natural realm? Would I not want to be attuned to everything that's going on around me? If I was crossing the street, would I not want my child to be completely aware of what's going on, vehicles coming, lights changing, anything that's going on? Isn't that what I would want? But no, not in the classroom. That child has to be focused. That child has to sit there for an hour and do this, or sit there for an hour and do that. Or when a question is asked, regurgitate the answer that the teacher had you memorize. Is that really the way we want to be? Of course not. Absolutely not. Still, this is what we do with our children. Over half of the children in this poor woman's classroom, Mary Ann, there you are, you're babysitting kids and expecting to, your superiors are expecting you to have these kids conform to some standard, some ideal that they are not. They are not supposed to feel good about themselves, about the way they are. They are not supposed to follow their natural inclinations. They are not supposed to be their creative, intuitive, perceptive selves. No. They're supposed to answer questions on a test and keep their eyes glued to paper or to you while you're speaking. It's pitiful. And same thing is happening within you and me. If ever you or I are doing something that just does not feel right, if we are living in a way that we are compromising ourselves, we are doing the same thing that Marianne is expected to do to these children in the classroom. Only we are so conditioned that we don't recognize it anymore and we do it to ourselves. So for me, Marianne, what you're saying here has everything to do with the children, of course, and I empathize deeply. However, it has to start right here. It has to do with me. What you're talking about here is me, because I'm doing this to myself. And I can only take care of myself first and foremost. An example is the best teacher. And if I can listen to my heart song, if I can dance when the urge comes to dance, and I can just get up and do something as simple as go out to pee when I have the urge to go out to pee, rather than having to ask the teacher or expecting to or learning to just hold it until a coffee break comes up or until this movie is over or whatever, I am going to be able to come all that much closer to my natural and spontaneous self. I'm going to naturally feel so much better about myself. I don't need any aspiration or any affirmations. I don't need any consciousness-raising exercises. I don't need to meditate. I don't need to do any of that other than just embrace, because I'm already there. Just embrace myself. Just love myself for who I am, how I am. I am going to be a shining example for everybody else. And I am going to create the structures around myself that are going to help other people to naturally be that too. And all the more, I'm not only going to do that, but I'm going to quit creating the structures and institutions around myself that keep other people from. You know, as Leo Tolstoy said, the kingdom of God is within you. And here it is. Just embrace it. We be it. We live it. We breathe it. Rather than striving for something out there, always out there. Now, out there is not only outside ourselves, but out there is also some distant future time, created or returned to whatever utopia we have envisioned. I think I went off on a tangent. That's okay. I would have been diagnosed with ADD for sure if the term existed when I was in school. So there are no tangents. How about that? Thanks for a reason. Cindy, would you like to come back on now and ask your question? Is this a good time?
Well, I do have one question based on the conversation you just had, which I really see what Marianne's saying in our culture, our education system, the mainstream, and I hear what you're saying, and it's beautiful. The only question I have is, can you comment on discipline and just discernment and discipline? I mean, is there a balance in there between just being 100% true to yourself, spontaneous? Is there ever a time when you need to have that discipline? Or do you know what I'm trying to say?
I think so. If you'd like to elaborate some more, that would be fine. I think I've got it, though.
Well, it's just like, okay, I mean, I don't know. This is just popping in my head, but just like, if you just keep going and going and going with what you want to do in the moment, do you ever become self-indulgent and then perhaps even destructive in a hurtful way? Like maybe for some reason you decide you do want to light someone's house on fire. I mean, I don't know. You know what I'm getting at? Like, I'm just looking for balance in there.
Yeah. That's a really good question. And I think I understand where it's coming from, and what I'd like to suggest is to look at, I know, I'll use the example of the wolf pack I lived with once. The individuals in that pack, Simba, Desham, Nishak, and Wolfie, and the others, were very much individuals. They were spontaneous beings. Right then and there, they picked up on things that were going on around them. They responded to whatever impulse there was. If they felt the need to pee, they would pee right then and there, just the way it went. Emotional expression was right there. They didn't think about it, just right there. And we might think, well, that's pretty wild, you know, that's pretty untethered. You know, what if we all did that? It would be a crazy world. You know, what happened there is that all of those wolves were so keen to each other because they were expressive of their feelings. They were right there. If one of them picked up on something, a disturbance, and the others didn't, everybody knew about it right away because they were so attuned to each other and they were so spontaneously expressive. So what might seem to be a disruption in the classroom, in a natural environment, would be an asset. And what happened, when I was living with that pack of wolves, I had five sled dogs as well. And the wolves lived together in a pack, but the dogs I could not keep together all the time because they would fight or they would run away or something. You know, I had to keep them chained up. And when a dog got in with the wolves, it was mayhem. Because, first of all, the dog was not a member of the pack, and the dog would either try to dominate or the dog would end up in defensive mode because the wolves were protecting their turf and trying to work out their relationship with the dog right there, right then and there. And every time I had to intercede because this dog could not be his spontaneous self in this context. It was an artificial situation where this dog did not have a real pack structure, and the pack structure did not mesh with the pack structure of wolves. Theoretically, they could get along. A dog is just a domesticated wolf in essence. Genetically, they're identical. So what happens here, and the parallel to your question here, is that our children are like dogs. They do not really have a pack structure. As if they evolved into children's culture, they could be these spontaneous beings just functioning as organs, finely tuned organs within this greater organism. And everything would work very nicely. The kids would be functioning within the context of their own pack, you might say. And you know, one children would be really perceptive, might have really finely keen senses. Another child might have a real sharp intellect, pick up on things very quickly and be able to process them. Another child might be very emotionally sensitive, and the rest of the pack of the kids would stay attuned to that child to see what the emotional climate, to check in on what the emotional climate of the pack was. And on and on and on, each of these children would be functioning as a semi-independent and vital organ within this organism. There would be no reason for them all to be the same and do the same thing at the same time. And imagine if we, let's take my body as an organism, or your body. I have, you know, my heart, my liver, and my spleen, and my pituitary gland. And they're all very unique organs. And they're all doing their own thing. And we want them to do that. I want the heart to do the heart, do its heart thing to the max, because I'm dependent upon that heart to pump blood through the rest of the system. And the liver wants the heart to do the heart thing to the max. And the heart wants the liver to do the liver thing to the max, right? We wouldn't want anything else. And The same with our children. If they were living in a children's culture, living naturally, we would want them to be all they can be, because this is the greatest contribution they're going to make to the other children and eventually to make to their people. If one child is destined to be a flitknapper, is very good with hand-to-head coordination, is very good at crafts, we want that child to go for it. Develop your skills. Do what you enjoy, because you are going to make a great contribution to your people. Now, if we try to force that child to conform to something else, hey, you have to study this and this and that, that child is not going to be the best flintknapper and is not going to be able to serve his people as he could, and is, above all, is not going to be as happy as he could. And here's where we get stuck in our culture, because we think that doing what we're called to do, being happy, listening to our hearts, is somehow compromising both ourselves and compromising our people. And it is not at all. It's the reverse. So if I am the person I can be to the fullest, I am going to be the happiest that way, and I am going to serve my people the best and help them to be the best. Does that make sense, Cindy? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. It really does. And I think the distinguishing point in there for me was that you're talking about children, and I really see that. And I'm thinking about adults, and what you're saying is that children will become adults. And so then where do we go wrong in history? What was it that caused humans to spin off and evolve to where we are today? I mean, there must be a good reason for that.
What's the reason? I've done a lot of research on the topic. I've got a whole section of my library material that I think relates to the topic, and I'm tempted to write a book on it, but it's such a broad topic. It seems as though a number of things have happened. That is, things that we can consciously grasp. And, you know, if we look at it as, well, where did we go wrong? Don't know if we went wrong, to tell you the truth. Maybe we need to do what we're doing now in order to recognize what the true beauty way is, and so that we can embrace it. And if we didn't do this, if we didn't go off on this tangent, let's just say this is a tangent, maybe we would have done something much worse. I don't know. I can only speculate. But I like to be as a question and be open to all possibilities. And just imagine that this is a teaching time for us. It's a teaching time for humankind. We can see what happens when we don't keep our beautiful brains in balance with our hearts. We go off on these crazy tangents. And stories are going to evolve from this. Tens of thousands of years from now, there are going to be legends of how we lived at one time. We died, ancestors died, maybe some terrible fate. Perhaps a few of us survived, and we were reborn again as humankind, living in balance again. And this is just, I'm not saying that this is going to happen. I'm trying to play prophet here. But this is one scenario. So, and this may be just what has to happen in order that something much worse doesn't happen. So I'm open to that possibility and many other possibilities as well. So your question about whether or not what is going on had to happen and whether we took a wrong turn somewhere just goes right back to being in the here and now again. You know, whether we're doing the right thing or the wrong thing, whether we could have done something else or could be doing something else in the future is really irrelevant. We have no idea as to what tomorrow is going to be. This is all we have. So if we can be true to, each of us as individuals can be true to who and how we are, that's the very best we can contribute to ourselves and to our people. Cosmos.
Thank you.
Can I elaborate on that more? Is there an edge that I didn't catch there to your question?
No, I think you got it. I think just the way I've been seeing it is that, you know, time moves in circles. It's not linear. And that, you know, we are on this human plane experiencing duality. And so it's often through what we don't like that we realize what we do like and appreciate things. And I think that's what you're saying in the greater context. And that at the same time, when we move in these circles and cycles, if you look back, like at the Golden Age and the Bronze Age and the Dark Age and whatever, it's, you know, there's been pockets of times that were beautiful and working. And at the same time, there's a layer of evolution with every circle. So you come full circle into this way of being that works and flows and people seem to be thriving. And then you know, the circle takes you into that duality again. And you come back in the circle more evolved in the flow. So that, yeah, I think that, I don't know if that made sense. What I'm trying to say is I don't know if we'll ever go back to the way where we're all living 100% with nature, with nothing man-made, because I think we're meant to live that way in balance with an evolution, if that makes sense. Because we're clearly out of balance now and very destructive, but I don't know if it means that we're going to completely end this cycle and then start fresh and new, 100% integrated with nature the way we were in the beginning.
Yeah, I got you. I got what you're saying, and I think you're right on. I agree. There's no way to go back. There's no way to recreate the past. Whatever is coming is going to be just like I am. I'm the sum total of all of the history that came to create me. And whatever our culture is going to be in the future is going to be the same thing. There's no way we can erase what's happening. No way we ought to erase what's happening. As I said, we're gaining very valuable teachings right now. We're going to have very valuable stories to come from this experience. And what is going to be in the future, who knows? And what's man-made and what's not man-made, everything we use is man-made. It really doesn't matter whether it's an arrowhead or a computer. It's still man-made. How all of that is going to work, I don't know. But I think what's important in what you're saying is that there's evolution going on, there's a transformation going on continually. You know, one saying that I like is that the only constant is change. Nothing's going to stay the same. Nothing is going to be as it once was. And here, if we just race and follow our hearts again, everything is going to fall back into place. I'm going to recognize that everything is in place right now, actually. With my earlier example, we're all of a sudden going to see the cities as forests that were rather than some man-made aberrations. We're going to treat them as forests. It's going to be the same city. However, the city is going to take on a different flavor. Bowl, living in the city bowl is going to be half full all of a sudden instead of half. We're going to see the pigeons and we're going to see each other. And we've always done, whether we were out in the savannah hunting gazelles or wolves or living in a medieval hamlet, doesn't matter. We're always doing the same thing. In and now. Just recognize.
Yeah, so basically all is good. All is good, even what seems so bad.
Yeah. I would even drop that last word instead of all is good, because that implies that something is not good. Say that. That's something that she who talks with loons gave me once when I was said, just simply to wrap it all up, what is it? All of a sudden, my travails start to melt away. Not travails anymore. I have created this travail, made a travail of it, or I'm approaching it as a travail rather than as teaching or as a feeling. There's so much that I can do to empower myself. Just get away from that autonomous perspective.
Thank you, Tamarack.
Oh, and thank you. My pleasure to share. I just got the nod that our time is about up. Yeah. Maybe 2 minutes yet. If anyone else has a question, we can explore a little something else. This is truly last chance. I'm teasing. Well, Cindy, you've been vocal here. Do you have any final comments? Do you have anything that you'd like to throw in yet?
Well, yeah. I would just like to thank you. It's been really fun to connect. I am living in the mainstream world, but I am a deep thinker. I'm sorry about that, but it serves me. It's my way of learning. And I'm a seeker, and I look for the universal truths. And I just love it that you're representing the native ways, the indigenous ways, and walking the talk. And I'm in the mainstream world, and yet it's not you against me, good or bad. I think we can have a symbiotic relationship just like you do with the animals. I'm talking about civilization mainstream, as opposed to trying to convert each other.
Nicely put. Yeah. Beautiful, Cindy. In fact, I would like to let that stand as closing comments here.
Okay.
It's the same thing I learned with the wolves, you know. There were wolves and there were dogs. And the dogs are wolves. There's no real difference. We distinguish them. And we try to make them something different. But those dogs, they wanted to go right in there with the wolves. They knew who they were. It didn't matter that I was trying to make sled dogs out of them. It didn't matter that they looked different. Their DNA said wolf, and it's the same with our DNA. We are all related. We are all one people. We can call ourselves Japanese or Chinese or native or civilized or do anything we want to do, or Christian or Muslim or Islam, blah, 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 blah. Those are all our constructs, our artificial constructs. We are one. We are all in relationship with each other. Let's just embrace that. Let's just be one great circle. I'll hold hands together.
Aho.
Aho. All right. Well, those of you who are listening now, and for those of you who will be listening, because this is going to be available online, I understand, just feel free if you have anything you'd like to explore or there's any way that I or we here at the Teaching Drum can be of help or service on your journey, on your life journey, please let us know. Or if you see how you can be of service to us and our journey here. You know, giving is receiving. We all help and support each other. Thanks to all of you who've been here, and Cindy especially, thanks for your questions. They've been really helpful as far as bringing forth the sharing. And to Mary Ann, too, it's a very rich email you sent. So much here in three paragraphs. This is pretty amazing. Very helpful. Thanks for sharing your heart. All right, here's a hug to all of you, and I hope the sharing continues in whatever ways are intended. So long for now.